Okay, well, thanks very much, Roger, and thank you, Michelle, for giving me the opportunity to tell you about some recent work that that we've been involved with. So, Michelle, I think I've got, what, 90 minutes? Is that right? For the no, there's nobody after me, right? So, no, I know. Right, so what I'm going to tell you about is actually quite an old and involved story, and I'm even somewhat embarrassed to still be in the business and talking about this problem, because it was one of the first problems that I worked on in frustrated magnetism ever, and it goes back to the mid-1990s, really. So I'm going to talk to you about this particular pyrochlore magnet, terbium titanate. This is a collaboration between my group at McMaster and people at NIST doing neutrons, and two different groups at Waterloo contributing in both theory and experiment. Geometrical frustration, this audience is already pretty familiar with, and a lot of these basic concepts have already been introduced. So I'm going to be talking about magnetic moments, localized magnetic moments, insulators, with magnetic moments that that decorate the vertices of tetrahedra, and then the materials that I'll be studying are basically cubic pyrochlores, which can be thought of as made up of networks of corner-sharing tetrahedra. So the tetrahedra, if you like, are to three dimensions what triangles are to two dimensions, and we have magnetic moments with different interactions and anisotropies, at least in principle, decorating these tetrahedra so that there can be degeneracies on a single tetrahedra, and then when you connect the tetrahedra together to fill three-dimensional space, you get some macroscopic degeneracy. So there's different ways that you can do this. One that has been very popular and relatively well appreciated of late is the type of degeneracy that you get when you combine local Ising-like anisotropy. So magnetic moments which are constrained to point either directly into or out of the tetrahedra, and a net ferromagnetic interactions. And it wouldn't take you very long to convince yourself that the best you can do in minimizing, you know, such a set of interactions and anisotropies is that you'd have what are referred to the ICE rules being satisfied, which is for every tetrahedra you have two spins pointing out and two spins pointing in. And of course, there are six different ways you can do that for a single tetrahedron, and then when you connect the tetrahedra together, you get the macroscopic degeneracy. So that set of interactions and anisotropies generates what's referred to as the spin-ICE problem. And the spin-ICE problem actually maps on to a very old problem, one that was introduced and essentially solved by, amongst other people, Linus Pauling, who was also referred to earlier as, he's really one of the heroic figures of science in the 20th century. And this was one of his other accomplishments besides RVB physics in benzene. He actually realized that there was what he referred to as a residual entropy associated with the structure of ice. So ice, water ice that is, the kind that you skate on, the kind that floats around in your drinks. Many of you probably know that that's not actually an ordered solid. The thing that is ordered in ice, at least in this phase of ice, is the positions of the oxygen ions. And the oxygen ions are arranged in this sort of hexagonal structure, and they have a fourfold coordination. And then they share protons which lie on this bond that connects two of the neighboring oxygen ions, but it's a hydrogen bond, so the proton will actually lie somewhere along that line, but closer to one of the oxygens than to the other. And then the ground state of ice you get by making sure that for its four nearest neighbor bonds, every oxygen has two protons which are relatively close to it, and then two farther away, so that locally it looks like a water molecule. Okay. But you've got two in and two out for the positions of the proton, and actually that maps on exactly in terms of a Siskel mechanics problem to the problem of having two spins pointing in and two spins pointing out for these Ising-like spins on a tetrahedra. So it ends up being the same sort of problem, and that's why it's referred to as spin ice. So, there's a number of interesting things about spin ice. Relatively recently, that's going back to 2007, Well, going back before 2007, of course, it was recognized as an interesting problem, one that had a macroscopic degeneracy. But then in 2007, the problem was recast into a problem of basically a dilute gas of magnetic monopoles as the elementary excitations in this system. And the idea is very simple, and it was alluded to a little bit in Gang Chen's talk as well, and that is that if you have near-neighbor spin configurations in the ground state, as you do up here, for two tetrahedra which share a corner, so you can see that these two tetrahedra, this has two spins pointing in and two spins pointing out, as does this one. And then we're going to put a defect. We're going to make an excitation on this system. And of course, given what I've told you, the only way to make a defect or an excitation is to flip one of these spins. So we'll flip this spin so that it points into this tetrahedron instead of this tetrahedron. And then what that does is that gives you three spins pointing in and one spin pointing out on this tetrahedron, and one spin pointing in and three spins pointing out on this neighboring tetrahedron. So by flipping that spin, you've created these two defects. And then given that you've created those defects can then drift away from each other at no additional cost in energy. So it's very much like the spin-on argument that Young Li presented in what was a one-dimensional case, where once you've created the domain walls, you can pull them away from each other at no additional cost in energy. So actually, it was realized that those defects will interact with each other as if they're magnetic monopoles, and actually even a lot of the same language that occurs in the study of real magnetic monopoles, like Dirac strings, which are the string of flipped spins that you would get as the monopoles separate, is used in this case. So that generated actually a lot of interest in this spin ice type problem. And the realizations for the spin ice physics actually fall, not exclusively, but largely within this particular family of cubic pyrochlores. So this is a family that actually my group and other groups, even other groups here, have spent a lot of time studying. There's a family of materials which is relatively easy to prepare, referred to as rare earth titanates, and they have the chemical composition R2 titanium 2 oxygen 7. The rare earth site is trivalent and typically magnetic. The titanium site is tetravalent and non-magnetic. Actually, as it turns out, both the rare earth sublattice and the titanium sublattice, they both look like independently, like this network of corner sharing tetrahedra. They're simply shifted one relative to the other. But it's the magnetic one connected with the rare earth sites that we're going to be following. And it's not quite true that you can go across the bottom of the periodic table and put any 4F metal ion site into this A site and get this type of structure, but that's almost true. You can certainly make a lot of them. Okay, and actually these are the different ones that we've made at different times, and they've been interesting for different reasons. And so as you pull out one rare earth and put in another, basically what you're changing are the nature of the ground state moment, the nature of the anisotropy, and the nature of the interactions. And with all these different possibilities, that gives you a lot of different combinations and therefore different exotic ground states. So for example, holmium titanate and dysprosium titanate end up demonstrating this classical spin ice type physics at low temperatures, and they've been the systems that have been studied most intensely for magnetic monopoles and Coulomb phases. Actually, ytterbium titanate is another system that we've studied relatively recently, and it's been of great interest as a quantum analog of the spin ice problem. So the spin ice problem, at least the way I briefly went through it a slide or so ago, completely classical arguments. So it would be very interesting, actually, if you could introduce quantum mechanics into that. And so this is one of the better candidates for doing that. And then there's things like erbium titanate, which actually are ordered at low temperatures, but we believe it selects out the order by an interesting mechanism. Gadolinium titanate, it's quite complicated, and it absorbs neutrons like crazy, so we have tended to avoid it. Anyway, what I'm going to talk about is actually the first of these that we studied, which was terbium titanate. who has a disordered ground state at low temperatures, and one that has really been very enigmatic. It's been referred to as a spin liquid, as a cooperative paramagnet. And even though it's been studied probably longer than any of the others, it's the one that is least well understood. So as I was mentioning, you know, as you switch in or switch out one of these rare earth ions, you get different ground state moments, different anisotropies, different interactions. And at least the ground state moments and the anisotropies are really a consequence of the effects of the crystalline environment, this very electronegative crystalline environment on the rare earth site. So the rare earth ion, say terbium 3 plus, is not sitting in a vacuum. It's experiencing a very strong electric field from eight oxygen ions, oxygen 2 minus ions, which are around it. And they're in the form of a distorted cube, where the cube has been distorted along the body diagonal. So there's a pair of what you might call apical oxygens that will give a preferred direction to the magnetism, actually, in the site. And then there's a buckled plane of oxygen ions that lies in the plane perpendicular to that. So I've labeled those oxygens as green and blue here, just because it's not a real plane. The oxygen ions actually move up and down. And the rotational symmetry about this axis where I've drawn the black arrow is actually threefold rather than sixfold. But that's somewhat of a detail. The net effect of all that is that the normal way you would go about calculating the ground state moment in any of these systems is that you'd start with Hund's rules, which is what you'd use for any of these systems if they were in isolation. And that gives you some total angular momentum J. It's 2J plus one fold degeneracy. And then the effects of this crystalline electric field will split that degeneracy up. And the nature of exactly how those eigenfunctions and eigenvalues split up will determine the size of the moment and the nature of the anisotropy. Okay. And so this is the sort of result that you get at the end of the day. These are low-lying eigenvalues for, say, ytterbium titanate, erbium titanate, and terbium titanate over here. And I'll just describe these two very briefly. So ytterbium titanate, you've got ytterbium 3 plus, which is a J equals 7 halves Hund's rule ground state, an odd number of electrons. And so you get 2J plus 1 is you got 8 crystal field levels, and actually they break up into 4 doublets, okay? And in this case, because it's an odd number of electrons, these states are protected by Cramer's theorem, which means that they have to appear in doublets or higher order multiplets. So that's not true for terbium titanate, which is over here. So in terbium titanate, you end up with J equals 6. So there's 2J plus 1. There's 13 crystal field levels. And at least the low-lying levels look like this. So the ground state is apparently a doublet. The first excited state, which is only 12 Kelvin above the ground state, is also a doublet. But then there are 3 singlets, you know, at about 100 and 150 Kelvin above the ground state. So the fact that you've got this low-lying doublet here is really somewhat unusual for this family of materials, at least. The splittings between the ground state doublet and the excited state doublet are typically much higher. And so what that means is that this low-lying excited state probably cannot be ignored in terms of trying to understand the low-temperature properties of this material, because at least in principle, the system can, even if you're at temperatures that are well below 12 Kelvin, the system can make virtual excitations from the ground state doublet to the excited state and back again, and that can influence properties. So I'm not going to go into any detail on this, but the eigenfunctions which make up these doubly degenerate eigenvalues actually correspond to XY-like symmetry in the case of ytterbium titanate and Ising-like symmetry in the case of terbium titanate. So the problem in which we have these Ising-like moments, these moments which can only point up or down or in or out relative to a tetrahedron, and they are coupled to each other with some Ising-like exchange term that you got over here between near neighbor spins on the tetrahedra, The minimal model for these systems, classically at least, would have that near neighbor Ising-like exchange coupling plus a term which accounts for the real dipolar interactions between the relatively large magnetic moments that are present in these rare earth magnets. So in case of terbium 3 plus, the ground state moment is around 4.5 Bohr magnetons. It's a big moment. And those big moments will interact classically via dipolar interactions, which only fall off like 1 upon r cubed, and we're in a three-dimensional solid. So these dipolar interactions can also be quite significant. At any rate, basically the phase diagram for this minimal dipolar spin ice Hamiltonian, so this is this is an exchange constant which can be either ferromagnetic or antiferromagnetic, and then the dipolar interactions. The phase diagram for this system, as I've defined it, actually was worked out by our very own Roger Melko and Michel Gingras in a couple of papers from 2000 and 2001. And this is the phase diagram here. You see temperature in units of the near neighbor dipolar interaction strength on the y-axis, and the ratio of the near-neighbor exchange interaction to near-neighbor dipolar interaction on the x-axis. The break between ferromagnetic and antiferromagnetic exchange is here at zero. Certainly, if the near-neighbor interaction exchange interaction is ferromagnetic, or if it's not adequately antiferromagnetic, then you go from a paramagnetic state through a crossover with this type of Schottky anomaly in something like the heat capacity into the spin ice type state, where the ice rules are progressively better and better satisfied as you go down in temperature. It's known that there is a lower energy ordered state. The spin ice state, of course, is disordered. There's a lower energy ordered state, but it's very hard to get into that lower energy state. And in fact, it's even hard to get into it via numerical simulations, and it's never really been convincingly seen in real experiments. So the spin ice disordered ground state has certainly been seen. This state has not been seen. Anyway, to sort of jump to the conclusion, given everything we know about terbium titanate, we actually expect it to lie, almost at the intersection of these different phases here, near minus one on this scale, but actually on the side of this antiferromagnetic state, which is complicated. It's a four sublattice non-collinear antiferromagnetic state, but it's still an ordered state. There's no macroscopic degeneracy associated with it. So it's, at least with this kind of minimal description, terbium titanate, should be, a rather conventional magnet, as opposed to the spin ice materials like holmium titanate and dysprosium titanate, which tend to lie over here. Okay, so that's all well and good. From our minimal description, we expect it to be a pretty well ordered magnet. The fly in the ointment, which has been known since at least 1999, is that that doesn't happen. Okay, so this is the 1 upon T1 relaxation rate from MuSR experiments on our first powder samples. And you see a very high 1 upon T1 relaxation rate, meaning that the system is fluctuating down to 20 millikelvin. Okay, and this is the type of powder diffraction pattern that you would see in this type of experiment. The very sharp forest of features here is due to the chemical periodicity, and it does have long-range chemical order. But then you've got this very broad liquid-like structure factor sitting underneath that, telling you that the spins, the terbium spins, are actually correlated over a distance of about a single tetrahedron, so quite a small distance. So this was the result of almost the first experiments we did on this problem, so that we knew actually very early on that there was something wrong with this rather minimal description. Okay, and so there's been actually two theoretical scenarios have been put forward to try to address this, both of which basically critically depend on knowing a lot about the crystal field levels. So one of these actually was, I should have had the reference here, but I didn't. So one of these was by Michel and co-workers, who suggested that because this excited state doublet is so close to the ground state doublet, it's rather easy to have have virtual transitions from the ground state doublet to the excited state doublet and back down again, which effectively renormalize the interactions in terbium titanate such that it gets pushed from this side of the phase diagram to the spin ice side of the phase diagram. And because these virtual transitions are, of course, quantum mechanical in nature, this would be one variant of quantum spin ice. Okay? But the net result would be, the net result would be that that terbium titanate would actually naturally go into a disordered spin ice-like ground state at low temperatures. Okay. So the other scenario that was put forward is basically that the ground state doublet in terbium titanate is not really a doublet. Okay. And it doesn't have to be, in fact. So so terbium 3 plus actually has six, eight F electrons. So its ground state doublet nature is not protected by Cramer's theorem. And the ground state could, in fact, be a non-magnetic doublet. So so even though these are the splittings between these groupings of levels, it could be, and this is what was proposed, that there's a splitting that arises at least at low temperature, probably because of Yon-Teller physics, which gives rise to a splitting in the ground state that's something less than about half a Kelvin, and that leaves you with a non-magnetic singlet ground state, and that's why the system doesn't order. Okay, so those are the two competing theories. I'm not really going to have that much to say about them, other than I just want to introduce them, but other than to say that we definitely have a magnetic ground state at low temperatures, and it's quite a surprise to us to discover some of the details of it. So again, you know, going historically, in due course, we did manage to grow single crystals of this material, and we performed different types of neutron experiments. And actually, for this set of experiments, because of problems with cryostats, we never got actually below about 0.4 Kelvin. But what we saw was actually consistent with our earlier measurements on powders, that we saw this kind of checkerboard pattern of diffuse elastic scattering that's centered on the OO2 position. So this is the OO2 position in reciprocal space right here. And we had this big square of scattering, which covers entire Brillouin zones. And you see that either in conventional diffraction or in time of flight scattering, in which we can separate inelastic scattering and elastic scattering. So that was known. And in fact, we knew that we could perturb the system. This is one of the nice issues associated with having F electron magnetism, Gang, Chen, this is for you. This is one of the nice things about, you know, having magnetic moments which interact via a relatively weak interaction term. It means you can perturb them. If their basic interaction is at 50 MeV, you know, you're never going to apply a magnetic field that can perturb that. But if it's more like one MeV, you probably could do that. Anyway, so you apply a magnetic field in the 110 direction. And so this is, if you like, the diffraction pattern that you start off with. And so we've got these chemical Bragg peaks here. These are due to the chemical periodicity of the lattice. And we've got this magnetic diffuse scattering at 400 millikelvin and in zero field. And then you apply even a very small field. And I'll show you later that you can apply a field as small as 0.1 tesla. And what happens is that you clean up all of this diffuse scattering and you condense a Bragg peak at the OO2 position, okay? And basically what you've done is you've polarized at least a subset of the system, so the order that you've generated in going from here to here is basically polarizing a set of very disordered spins. Not all of them, mind you, but a lot of them. And then if you keep going up in field, you can actually generate, if you like, a different bona fide antiferromagnetic state with this set of new Bragg peaks that go right across here. Okay, so there's a fairly rich phase diagram. We can get into a real ordered state fairly easily by perturbing it with a field. We can polarize this disordered state very easily at low temperatures, but we seem to have this very disordered state at least down to 400 millikelvin, and that's why it's been referred to in the literature as alternatively a spin liquid state or a cooperative paramagnetic state or what have you. Okay, so that brings us to about a year ago. And about a year ago, we've been working on this system for so long that we were doing what I thought was going to be, and I've thought this several times actually, but I thought this was going to be our last experiment on this system, cleaning up some loose ends in high field. Okay, and at the very end of the experiment, we said, we've got a little bit of time left, let's go back, just turn the field off, do a base temperature measurement, and just confirm that, you know, we are where we think we are. And we weren't, right? And so this is the new set of measurement on the same crystal, so we couldn't even blame the crystal, on the same crystal. And so we no longer see that checkerboard of diffuse scattering around the 002 position. Instead, we see rather intense Bragg-like features. They're not really Bragg features. They're not really Bragg peaks, but they're Bragg-like features. And they sit, if you like, at the corners of that square of diffuse scattering. Okay? But it's different. It's completely different from what we've seen before. And I was flabbergasted when we saw this. So we saw this at the very end of an experiment. We had to wait 6 months to go back and do some more. But in the meantime, even though we've got these this relatively small amount of data, we've got about 11 magnetic positions. And even though they're not really in sharp Bragg peaks, you can certainly add up all the intensity within these, and you can do, you know, a form of magnetic crystallography. And of course, this isn't a unique description, but the best description that we got was that locally, on the scale of one conventional unit cell, the system is essentially in a spin ice ground state, okay, on the length scale of one unit cell. But when you go from one conventional unit cell to the next and then on to the next, every conventional unit cell that you step away, you put in a pi phase shift to all the spins. So if you like, we've been referring to it as an antiferromagnetic short range spin ice state, because each one of these conventional unit cells is in a spin ice ground state, but then they're antiferromagnetically correlated from one conventional unit cell to the next. And the correlation, the length scale over which these are correlated is about one conventional unit cell. So you can make one step in any direction. That means you have eight conventional unit cells that make up a correlation volume, if you like. And the correlation lengths are very isotropic, as you would expect for a cubic system. So quite a surprise to get something that has as much order in it as this seems to have. Okay. So then we went on from there. So we had this surprising state with these half Bragg peaks, and then we applied our 100 magnetic field. And very quickly destroyed it. Okay, so it's about 0.075 Tesla that it takes to go from this type of diffraction pattern to this type of diffraction pattern. Okay, so this is a fingerprint for having polarized half of the spins in the pyrochlor lattice, the so-called alpha chains. That's somewhat of a detail, but basically we're going from whatever this local spin ice state to a polarized state in about 0.075 Tesla. Okay, so it doesn't take much of a magnetic field energy to break up this this low temperature, low field state. Okay. But then we were left with the issue of, there's a whole bunch of issues here that when you see this sort of thing, any self-doubts that you had about your competence as an experimentalist and such, they all come to the fore. You wonder why you didn't see this before. You've been at it 15 years. How could you possibly have done this? Then, of course, you blame the postdoc and the graduate students and such, but eventually it comes back. So here we are. This is the same data that I was showing you before. And so now we're going to thermally destroy this. We're just going to raise the temperature from 0.1 Kelvin or so, and we go up to about 600 millikelvin, and we pretty much get rid of it. Actually, we don't really get rid of it. What we do is we go from this sort of state to a state which is starting to look a lot more like what we were familiar with. It's starting to look a lot more like this checkerboard pattern, this big square. Okay, so going from 80 millikelvin to 400 millikelvin. And then we cool back down and try to do it again, because of course we want to try to understand this well. And lo and behold, we don't actually get back to where we were before. We generate probably a little bit more in terms of form to the diffraction pattern when we went from 400 back to 100 millikelvin, but we don't get back here. Okay, so it took us a while to come to grips with this, but there's a clear history dependence to what we're seeing at low temperatures. And in a sense, that made me feel better, because You know, history-dependent features, especially in neutron scattering, can be very tricky to track down, because neutron scattering experiments take a while. You know, these data sets take 12 hours or so to acquire. So you're not going to go through all possible permutations of how you get from one state to another lightly. You're not going to do that lightly. But nonetheless, we had pretty compelling evidence that it wasn't all that easy to get into this state. And that, you know, for example, you could easily, end up at zero field and about 80 millikelvin and get this sort of diffraction pattern. In fact, these two data sets were taken, you know, they're taken under, you know, essentially the same conditions, although there's a different history. So basically, you know, just I'll sort of jump to the answer. You know, basically, this system has had its spins polarized by applying a magnetic field and then coming back down. And this one hasn't. So this, if you like, is a field-cooled state, and this is a zero-field-cooled state. And actually, that's a very common distinction amongst spin-glassy-type states, that you get somewhat different results under field-cooled conditions and zero-field-cooled conditions, even though you're ostensibly under the same, taking data in the same conditions. So anyway, so we had these temperature scans as a function of temperature. And even though we didn't get back to exactly where we were before, we could scale the data. And they kind of all looked the same, that whatever structure you had at low temperature, you would definitely have less of it if you went up above something like 275 millikelvin, 300 millikelvin. And then by the time you got to about 600 millikelvin, you were back to the square. Okay. So, you know, that came as a big surprise. It came as a big surprise, you know, that we had this history-dependent phase at low temperatures, but actually it really shouldn't have, because in the literature, there was already data very much like this data here. This data is actually unpublished data from Peter Schiffer and Bob Kava, who we're also collaborating with on a different aspect of this problem. But the data I want you to look at is the data in green. And this is the imaginary part of the AC susceptibility. And there's a cusp in both of these features, just below 200 millikelvin. And actually, these sorts of features have been seen by a number of different groups on a number of different samples, some powder samples, some single crystal samples. They show a frequency dependence in the AC susceptibility. It's very characteristic of a glassy state below about, in this case, about 200 millikelvin. But depending on the sample, you can go anywhere, and the frequency, you can go anywhere from, you know, something like 100 millikelvin to about 300 millikelvin. So having our half Bragg peaks disappear at about 275 millikelvin is roughly consistent with all this. Okay. So the other aspect to this, and this comes about because we're doing time of flight neutron scattering. So we're doing neutron scattering that's a little bit different from what Young Lee was showing earlier. But I've been showing you elastic scattering maps. So scattering maps where you're looking at the elastic scattering to within about 0.1 MeV. But it's a time of flight experiment. We get these very large data sets, and we can look at it in energy, in Q. We can slice and dice it, you know, many different ways. In fact, it takes a long time to look at it in all of its complexity. So this was the original experiment, okay? And now, so these are the peaks at a half that we got. We didn't really know why we got them, but we got them. And now we're gonna take all the data, not just the elastic scattering data, but all the data that falls, you know, within this black square, which is basically the half magnetic zone center, and we're gonna look at the energy dependence of that as we warm the system up, okay? So what you see is that at these low temperatures, like 80 millikelvin, the spectrum is actually gapped below about 0.1 MeV. And then as you warm up and get rid of the elastic scattering, you know, this is intensity on a log scale, so the low temperature data set is gapped in the low energy excitation spectrum, but that spectral weight appears under the elastic, in the elastic scattering. So this spectral weight is moving from the inelastic spectrum to the elastic spectrum. Again, this is typical of a spin freezing transition. And if you move up in temperature, by the time you get to 275 millikelvin, you've actually recovered pretty much all of the spectral weight within the gap, and then you just keep that going forward. So that was for our original crystal. We then grew two more different single crystals, which were slightly different from each other. I'm not really going to go into any detail. And basically, we got this data that you see here. Again, this is the field cooled state. So this is the diffraction pattern that you get. This is the zero field cooled state. This is the diffraction pattern that you get, both at low temperatures, both at 80 millikelvin. And then, you know, this is what the inelastic spectrum looks like. So if you have sharp half-half-half quasi-Bragg peaks, you have a gapped inelastic spectrum. If you've got this checkerboard type almost square pattern at low temperatures, you don't have a gap spectrum. You've got quasi-elastic scattering going down to the lowest energies we can measure. And no matter what you had at base temperature, if you warm up to 300 Kelvin, you'll fill in the gap. Okay. So that leaves us with this phase diagram, which we now think we understand much better. So this is magnetic field, actually in the 110 direction on a logarithmic scale, and temperature on the logarithmic scale. So this is the cooperative paramagnet that generated the original interest. And basically, if you take this down to low fields, but they have to be very low fields, you get this checkerboard type pattern, a very disordered type pattern. And actually, you will get this, as long as you don't turn on a magnetic field, you'll get this type of diffraction pattern all the way down to arbitrarily low temperatures, okay? And then as you come up here, so none of this region here in blue is history dependent, okay? It's all disordered. If you start to apply a magnetic field along here, you can come over here and you get this field polarized state, and that deforms continuously into the checkerboard state, okay? But none of this has any history dependence to it. None of this part in green has any history dependence to it. It's a conventional ordered state. So this is the diffraction pattern that goes with the ordered state. This is the diffraction pattern that goes with the polarized state. This is the diffraction pattern that goes with the cooperative paramagnet, so long as you don't turn the field on. And this is the diffraction pattern that you get if you go down to low temperatures in any way, and then turn on a field above about 0.1 Tesla and come back down again, you'll generate this state. And that state with the half-half-half Bragg peaks, it's not just a different field cooled state. I mean, it's really different from the zero field cooled state, but it's also gapped, okay? Big change in the elastic scattering. It's, you know, it's in this local antiferromagnetic spin ice ground state, and that ground state is clearly gapped, okay? And that's to contrast it with the zero field state, which has you know, much shorter correlations. You know, there's some similarity between these two patterns, but it's much shorter correlations, and it's not gapped, right? There's spectral weight right down to zero energy. Okay, so this part in red is history dependent, and that's why we missed it for all that, those years, because we didn't happen to hit upon the right protocol for bringing the sample down to low temperatures and then putting on a field. We could have done it, but we didn't, okay, until relatively recently. So anyway, I'm sure I've run over time. So with that, I'll just thank the people that actually did the work, and thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Bruce. Any questions?
No, the gap that develops at very low temperature, it doesn't look like an icing gap. Anisotropy.
Right. It's not clear. There's definitely strongly suppressed spectral weight, but it doesn't have a sharp edge to it. That's correct.
So does it have a message? I mean, there could be some kind of local spin liquid.
Yes, yeah, because there could be some spectral weight going down to zero energy. That's what you're saying. Still, even though it's depleted there. That's possible. Yes. Well, it's not magnetically ordered. Right. They're not really ordered. Yeah, they have, the correlation length is about 8 angstroms. So it's really in this frozen, it's almost like a cluster glass. You might think of it as a cluster glass.
I just wanted to make sure I understood this right. The antiferromagnetic spin glass state, does that have zero uniform moment?
Yes, it has zero uniform moment, right.
So it's rather surprising that this only exists when you cool in a field.
Right, but it's very easy to polarize. Yeah, that's right. Actually, something that I didn't say, you know, one of the ways you can think about the pyrochlore structure, there's different ways you can think about the pyrochlore structure, but one of the ways you can think about them is in terms of what's referred to as alpha chains and beta chains. So you can think of half of the spins in the pyrochlore lattice residing on one set of chains that run along a particular 110 direction. And then there's an orthogonal set, which are usually referred to as beta chains, that run the other direction. And you know, half the spins lie on one, half the spins lie on the other. And so if you have Ising-like moments that can only point into or out of the tetrahedron, the effect of a 110 field will be to polarize the alpha chains, and that leaves the beta chains decoupled. And you can do that it's not much of a field that you need in order to do that. As I said, it's only 0.075 Tesla, basically. And the signature that you get, that 002 peak, that is here, right, this is a signature of, I mean, I didn't say this, but this is a signature of the alpha chains being polarized. So if you polarize just the alpha chains, you get a big 002 peak.
How do you, you showed some early MuSR data from that we did with Jason, which was down in the, certainly in the low field regime, but doesn't see any sign. I mean, that's very much a local probe, and probably, you know, the local tetrahedron may not be so different in any case. They don't seem to see any sign of this frozen spin ice state. Do you have any idea where what's going on there?
I don't, is the short answer. The only thing I would say is that, you know, even when you're in this state, and this, you know, all comes just to clarify for David, who's walking away, but anyway, that you know, these things that I've been calling, you know, Bragg peaks and quasi-Bragg peaks, they're not, you know, they're short range ordered peaks, right? So it is pretty short range ordered, and it could be that the local magnetic environment actually doesn't change very much. Having said that, there's a big loss in spectral weight as you go down to low temperatures in the field cooled state, and I would have thought that MuSR would be very sensitive to that. So, I'm sort of giving you a core dump rather than, giving you a good explanation, but that's the best I can do.
Maybe one more quick question. No, if not, let's thank Bruce for a wonderful talk. And as Michel comes up to give his closing remarks, let Bruce and I be the first to thank him for getting this Four Corners workshop together. He's done a great service to the community of condensed matter theory and experiment in southwestern Ontario. So thank you, Michel.